This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Firstly, welcome back to all of you who have been regulars at the Monday Night Shiur and who rejoined us after several weeks of recess due to my having been overseas on some international consulting assignments. And secondly, welcome to those of you who are not regulars at the Shiur and are joining us for the first time. It's very lovely to have you with us, to see you. I will say a shiur is made successful only in part by the person and the content of who is delivering and the delivery, but to a large extent the success of the shiur depends on the people who are there. Firstly, what kind of people come. When good people come, bright people come, intelligent people come, that gives people the impression that it's a good shiur even if it isn't. So already I feel indebted to intelligent people for coming, just for creating that aura around the shiur. But more important, there is no question that the there is impact in the sense of intelligent, active, vital faces in an audience elicits a certain response from the person giving the shiur. And so having you here this evening certainly helps me do the best I can to deliver a shiur that will hopefully be worthy of your presence. I have decided for the summer months to suspend the Shiurim on Shmuel because it's likely during the summer months, as previous experience has shown us, that there will be a fairly transient group of people. Some people go away for some weeks, they're here for some weeks, and it breaks the continuity. So instead, for the summer months, I'm going to be dealing with specific topics. I'll be open to ideas from you if there's specific topics that you want me to address. I don't undertake to address every topic that you suggest, but I would certainly like to hear what are the things that are on your minds and what you think are on the minds of the people you know that you would find value in getting some insights from the Torah's perspective as I'm able to apply it, and we'll do that. Sometimes we'll use the subject as the core and branch out from the subject. Sometimes we'll use a piece of learning from the previous week or the coming week or something that's taking place at this time in the calendar, and we'll use that as the springboard. But each time we'll get into a particular area of study. I think that what's going to typify most or all of the series of Shiurim will be dealing with the managing, learning to manage some of the paradoxes of life. Because if I were to try and classify the various different issues that are brought to me in terms of things people struggle with, what people struggle with is the paradox. When things are straightforward, it's not a struggle. I'm talking about an existential struggle. People have their own material struggles and physical struggles and social struggles. But what they struggle with ideologically is usually the existence of paradox, of contradiction, of question, of conflict, of philosophic conflict. And it's that I want to address in this shiurim, and it's that I'm going to attempt to do so. Tonight's shiur is sponsored, for those of you who are not familiar with the process. We've elected to have the shiur in this venue rather than just in some hall or at some shul or even at our own shul, just because we're learning Torah, and Torah has glory and majesty to it, and it's unfortunate that most of the venues in which we choose to do our religious things lack some of the majesty that ought to go with the Torah. And we decided to have it here. We could have the shiur in a bright, nice, pleasant surrounding, a place that's convenient to get to, it's an easy location to access, and so we chose to have the shiur here. But with that come certain costs. And the cost of entry into the shiur doesn't anywhere near cover the costs of having the shiur and catering for the shiur here. So in addition to the entry, people volunteer sponsorships for the shiur. They do so in honor of various people or just themselves for whatever reason, and that makes it possible for us to continue having the shiur in this particular venue. For tonight's shiur, I would like to thank Ira Melman on behalf of all of us for the sponsorship. Ira, appreciate your kicking it off, not only with the sense of generosity of being the first to jump in before anybody even asked for any sponsorships, but also with a beautiful dedication of this sponsorship in appreciation of PJC's outgoing president, Mr. Jeff Groom, whose countless hours of effort, his talent and dedication have been so much responsible for PJC's success, and also in recognition of Roy Blumenstrahl, who has bravely stepped into the breach and who will lead PJC to new heights in the future. Thanks, Ira, for those words. Thanks for your dedication. Thanks for your generosity. I appreciate that. What I'm here to deal with tonight, I started dealing with already in shul on Shabbos. I think it's important for many of you to appreciate that the various shiurim that I give are actually all interlinked. They're all different, looking at the same picture from different angles. Unfortunately, nobody can come to all of them, because there's one shiur which is only for ladies, and there's one shiur which is only for men. But apart from that, there are some people who do come to all of them, and each one gives a different angle, and sometimes we deal with the same or similar concepts at the same time in the different shiurim and tackle them from different angles. The shiur that takes place right here just before this shiur that starts at 7:30, is a Gemara shiur, a Talmud shiur, which is the very essence of Jewish thinking and reasoning. The Monday night shiur is suitable for beginners, for people who have not learned Gemara before. We will be complementing that with a second shiur, which will be more sophisticated for people who have learned and are willing to dedicate several hours a week to preparation, about which we'll make an announcement in a few days, hopefully. But the Monday night shiur at 7:30 is a Gemara shiur that's open to anybody. The lady shiur is no longer on Wednesday morning, that's now been moved to Friday morning, at the same time and the same place. So that's at 8:40 in my boardroom in West Los Angeles. That's for the women. We're studying women and issues relating to femininity through the Tanakh, starting with wherever there is a female issue in the Tanakh. We study that in some detail and apply it to current situations. And then also on Friday morning at 7 o'clock, there's a breakfast shiur at the shiur on the beach, which is the Kuzari shiur, Jewish philosophy, Jewish thinking, preceded by the davening for those who wish to daven. And then on Shabbos morning, there is the shiur that I give in shul, where I began to deal with the issues that I'm going to deal with tonight. And some of you who are there will hear a review of some of those ideas in part of tonight's shiur. In trying to identify the kernel of paradox, where does it really start from? Where in the Torah do we have the most paradoxical paradox that we can start our analysis, that we can start to understand the principles of paradox? Because only once we've understood the principle of paradox can we begin looking at how to manage the various different paradoxes, the specific paradoxes that take place in our lives. And we find that there is in fact a body of laws that are paradoxical. Consider for a moment. Let's look at those chairs. There's some chairs up in front here. Consider for a moment what God is. There can be no one or no concept more rational than God, by definition. This is the creator of reason. This is the master of logic. This is the creator of everything scientific, everything. There's no area of logic or rational thinking that isn't an outcome of God and godliness. And therefore God is a source of that which is rational. we then understand the question that the wise son asks at the Seder table? He says, Ma ha'edus v'ha'chukim v'ha'mishpotim asher tzivu Hashem l'kechem eschem. What are the... And then he uses three different words to describe laws. Edus, chukim, and mishpotim. What are those three words? The Maharal of Prague in the Tiferes Yisrael chapter 48 defines them in the following way. Ki ha-Torah yesh bo gimel chalokim. The Torah has three parts to it, three different styles. And he quotes that verse of the wise son, Ma ha-Edus v'ha-chukim v'ha-mishpotim. Chukim, he defines chukim, and I'm going to come to that last, the way he defines it first. Ha'edus, let me go through his order. Chukim hem le'elonim legamri b'nei Adam. The chok is a law whose reason is completely beyond human capacity. But who is by up your da'adakam? God knows the reason. We don't. Ha'edus, shem gamri le'elonim b'nei Adam. The second category, edus, also defies human logic. But once a human being has studied them, he understands it. So he would never have thought of it. But having been exposed to it, he says, yeah, that makes sense. That's an Eidus. When you do that with a Chok, he doesn't say, that makes sense. So the Chok is a law, you even after explaining to him, he still says, that doesn't make sense. That's a Chok. Eidus, you explain it to him, he says, that makes sense. And Mishpotim, hey, mitzvahs, you do sha'afim lo nam with dimu shi'im ha'amayim. Mishpotim are those laws which even if God had never given us, we would have kept because they're so rational. Not to steal, and to honor parents, there are certain laws that you don't need the Torah for. Those laws don't even have to be given to us. So the mishpotim are laws which are so rational that we could have deduced them even without the Torah. The edus are laws which we could not have deduced without the Torah, but having received them in the Torah, we understand their rationality. And the chukim are those laws which even after hearing them in the Torah, they still don't make any kind of rational sense. Three categories of law. That first category, the chok, is the origin and the essence of paradox. That God should legislate laws that have no apparent reason is where paradox finds itself in the Torah. Not in life experience, just in academically, when we have an academic source of paradox. But God should acknowledge, here are a body of laws, and you know what, not only will you never understand the reason on your own, but there's no way I can even explain the reason to you. So forget it, just do it. That isn't consistent with the whole essence of Jewish learning and Jewish thinking, and what the Torah is all about. The Torah is about questioning and about challenging. Anybody who's learned a single page of Gemara, how many questions are there on a page of Gemara? Dozens. Every single page is just filled with questions. Asks the Gemara, answers the Gemara, attacks this one, questions that one. Rashi asking, Tosfos asking, everybody. The whole body of Jewish knowledge is constructed through the process of questioning. The existence of a body of law that cannot be questioned in Jewish thinking is paradoxical. In any other religion it would be normal because other religions are based on dogma. But our religion is based on reason. A religion based on reason, created by the master of reason, that contains laws that have no reason, is the essence of paradox. And therefore the study of Chok, which we introduced to in last week's Seder, the parasha that we read this last Shabbos, was the prime example of the Chok, which we'll discuss. We had the academic precedent for paradox. Let's take it further and gain some understanding. There's another strange point which I also raised in Shul, and that relates to two episodes. The one is also in the piece of Torah we read on Shabbos, famous story when Moshe and Moses hits the rock instead of talking to the rock, and the outcome of that, God gets angry. God told him to talk to the rock, he hits the rock, God gets angry and says, for that you're not going to go into Israel. Terrible punishment for Moshe, for striking the rock instead of speaking to it. So Moshe is denied access into Israel because he strikes the rock. Much earlier on, when God tells Moshe to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, Moshe enters into dialogue with Pharaoh and debates the whole issue. Pharaoh gets angry and turns the screws on tighter and makes the Jews work even harder as slaves. the Jews object and they come with a claim against Moshe, understandably. Why would you come to interfere? Before you came, things were better. Ever since you've come, it's been worse and worse. Moshe gets upset and defends the Jewish people and turns against God. And says to God, why did you send me to Pharaoh? Why have you brought me here? You've made things worse for this nation since I've come. Since I've arrived and has begun to dialogue with Pharaoh in your name, he ran on Hazeth, has gotten worse for this nation. And God, you haven't delivered on your promise to save your nation. They're still in slavery and they're worse off than ever before. Very courageous of Moshe. Moshe challenges God and accuses him of failure. What does God do? God says to Moshe, now you're going to see. Oh, he says, just wait. It's coming. Just wait. In a few moments, you're going to see what I'm going to do to Pharaoh. Says Rashi, there is an implied sting in that word. Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Says Rashi, but you will not see what I'm going to do to the seven kings of Palestine, because you're not going to go to Palestine. You'll only see now what I do to Pharaoh. And the reason you won't go is because you've questioned me. Not like Abraham. Abraham, when I told him to sacrifice his son, just after I had told him that his son was going to be his gateway to the future, and that Yitzhak was going to father a great nation, Yitzhak is his only child, and Yitzhak doesn't yet have children, and then I say to him, sacrifice Yitzhak. Abraham didn't say to me, but that's absurd. Last month you told me that Yitzhak would be my future, and now you're telling me to kill him? Abraham didn't do that, he didn't question. But you, Moses, you have questioned me, and the result of that is you won't go to Israel. You won't see what I do to the seven kings. You'll only see what I do to Pharaoh in Egypt. And apart from the obvious question of, that sounds like quite an insecure response, doesn't it? The boss is challenged, and the result, now you're suffering. You're off to Siberia for that. That's a strange kind of a response. In addition to that, what's strange is we know that the reason that Moshe didn't go to Israel is because he struck the rock. Here it appears that it was decided long before the issue of the rock that he wasn't going to go. So why make such a big deal? Ha! You struck the rock. I said speak to it and you struck it. You won't go to Egypt. You won't go to Israel. But I wasn't going to go in any case. You already decided in Egypt that you were going to ban me from going into Israel. So how do we understand this? Third question is, the Gemara deals with the order of events at the beginning of this parasha of Chukas. First we're introduced to this very absurd sounding law of the red heifer. The red heifer was the means by which a contaminated person could be purified so that he could enter the temple. That's the reason why today, if you go to Jerusalem, they offer tours of the Temple Mount, but we're not allowed to go. So if you're offered a tour of the Temple Mount, you have to decline. Why? Because we are contaminated. We've come into contact with dead bodies and all sorts of things, all sorts of forces of spiritual contamination, and we therefore may not go into the... Temple Mount contaminated. The way we decontaminate is by having the ashes of the red heifer sprinkled on us. And there's a whole procedure as to how the red heifer is slaughtered, and then its carcass is burnt, and it's mixed with water, and that water is sprinkled, and that decontaminates us. And the red heifer is a very unusual animal. If it has two hairs that aren't red, it's not a red heifer. And there hasn't been one around for thousands of years since the last temple. And they discovered one a year or two ago. They discovered one in Israel. It was a little calf, and they looked after it very carefully. But it has since developed a few non-red hairs, so that's not working. But before we can rebuild the temple, we're going to have to find a red heifer. And it's very valuable, so if any of you find a red heifer, you better look after it well and let somebody know. The law of the red heifer, we're told about the death of Miriam. Miriam was the sister of Moshe, and it is in her merit that there was a portable well that followed the Jewish people as they walked through the desert. So they always had water. When she died, that water dried up. And that brought them to the whole episode of the rock. Now the Jews started saying, but we've got no water. And they got angry and they started yelling at Moshe. Moshe prayed to God. God said, speak to the rock. Take your stick and speak to the rock. Moshe takes the stick and hits the rock. Moshe vanished from Israel. What's the sequence of these episodes? Says the Gemara to teach us that just as the death of righteous people atones, so the red heifer atones, the paraguma atones. And that's strange. Firstly, what is the connection? So they both atone. There are lots of things that atone. Prayer can atone, fasting can atone, charity can atone. There are lots of things. Why connect these two? The death of a righteous person, the death of Miriam, and the red heifer. And secondly, more important is, did the death of Miriam cause atonement? What did it actually cause? The result of it was no water. The result of no water was people were angry and irritated. The result of that is Moshe got angry and he disobeyed God. He hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock. It caused sin. It didn't cause repentance. So this is a real bad example of where the death of a righteous person caused atonement. On the contrary, the death of this righteous person caused our greatest man of all times to sin. The one major sin that he committed, which cost him entry into Israel. That's the example. The fourth one is, King Solomon says, Amalti ahakmo vehir echoiko mimeni. I said to myself, let me become wise and understand every law of the Torah. But this one, the law of the red heifer, the chokam and any, this I could never grasp. Solomon acknowledges the man who knew every language, who knew every science, the man who knew kings and philosophers, and every wise person of the time would come to King Solomon to discuss issues with, to seek advice. This was the most brilliant man that has ever lived. He says, I understood the whole Torah, except for this one law. And yet God says to Moses, I will tell you the reason for this law. Even Solomon won't know the reason. You will be the only human being who understands the philosophy and the logic behind the red heifer. That's interesting, because what that means is that to understand a chok, because the red heifer is the archetype chok, to understand a chok, intellectual brilliance is not the tool. Because if intellectual brilliance were the tool, Shlomo would have understood it. There would be nobody cleverer than that. Moshe was not as clever as Shlomo. King Solomon was brighter than Moses. Moses was a greater prophet. Moses was a more saintly man. But Solomon was the cleverer. And with all his brilliance, he couldn't grasp the chok. What we learn is there is a body of knowledge that requires something other than intelligence to understand it. And Moshe had that thing, and Solomon and nobody else has. What is it that you need in order to understand the chok? And where do you get it? How much does it cost? Those are the questions for this evening. Now, what is so peculiar about this law? It's not sure it's not the only law that's difficult to understand, so you've got to sprinkle some water over yourself and then you become okay. And is that more difficult to understand than the law of mikveh, than the law that you drop into natural spring water or rain water, and that purifies? Is that easier to understand? Sacrifices, is that easier to understand? What is it about this law, this red heifer, that Solomon couldn't grasp? Every other law he could understand. But this one, there was a mystery in this law that he couldn't grasp. What was the mystery? The Midrash tells us, Eov, in fact, Job, comments on what it is. And he says a phrase which the Medrash interprets. Mi yitain tohu mitome lo echot. Who can create purity out of impurity? Surely the only one? That's the one. Truly only God can create purity out of impurity. For example, and the Medrash then gives several examples of what Eov is referring to. Number one, who's our forefather? We very conveniently say we're all descended from Abraham. Was Abraham the first one? Who's that?
It's
We conveniently say that our forefather was Terah when it was Avraham, but that's not true. Avraham wasn't the first man. Avraham had a father too. Why do we consider ourselves descendants of Avraham? Why do we say we're descendants of Terah? Terah was Avraham's father, and Terah was an idol worshipper. He was one of the biggest idol worshippers the world has ever known, the worst of the worst. So the man who is the seed of the Jewish nation had an origin, and that origin was decadence and degeneracy. That's Torah mitome, to produce purity out of impurity. That only God does, because normal genetic inheritance produces a similar kind of genetic trait in the child that the penim had. To take something that is totally impure and produce something that is totally pure, that doesn't make scientific sense. Therefore, that's godly. To produce an Avraham out of a Terah, that's miraculous. Chizkiyahu me'achaz. Same kind of thing. Chizkiyahu comes from Achaz. Yoshiyahu comes from Ammon. Mordechai comes from Shimi. A list of great people who came from terrible people. Ha'olam habo me'olam hazeh. The world to come is the product of this world. This world is secular and it's profane and it's contaminated, and we're engaged in it, and it's difficult and challenging and problematic. It's certainly not pure. And out of this world we produce the world to come. Miyoso came, who did that? Mitzivo came, who instructed that? Migozo came, who decreed that? Lo yechido shel olam, only God himself. In the same way, the red heifer produces a product that is so contaminated that anybody involved in its production had to be cleansed. Anybody who created this product of the mix of the water and the ashes and the hyssop and the cedar and the, all the rest of the things that I didn't get into, the people who busied themselves with that manufacture were contaminated and needed to be cleansed. And yet the product they produced cleansed. Strange, the activity was contaminating and the outcome was cleansing. This pure outcome from a contaminated product is miraculous. Or to use the word that we've been using, paradoxical. That is paradox. To take something that is completely impure and to create something that is 100% pure out of it, that is paradox. And that's what Shlomo couldn't understand about the red heifer. Not all the procedures and the rituals, that's easy, you can find reasons for that. But to try and understand how something negative can create something positive. Not something partially negative can create something partially positive, but that something totally negative can create something totally positive, that he struggled with. And this Medrash leads us to understand that what Shlomo grappled with was not only the law of the red heifer. What Solomon grappled with was all paradox of this nature. Any great purity that comes out of impurity, any great positive that comes out of negative, Shlomo grappled. Couldn't understand it. Moshe was given the answers. But if we look and we try and understand, what are examples of that? The good out of the bad, if we say the essence of Chok, the essence of this kind of statute, this paradoxical law that defies logic, is the creation of good out of bad. And it's not just the creation of good out of bad, it's the natural outcome, bad leading into a natural outcome that is good. That paradox is something we find in many areas. It's an understanding of the good that can come out of pain. Now, when a person is suffering pain, very hard for them to hear that ultimately it could be good for them. When they suffer in pain, that's it. We know how we feel even when there's a little thing wrong with us. Just a sore foot or a headache or a cold or a little bit of flu, and it's the end of the world. We can't cope. Certainly when there's major suffering, very difficult for somebody to hear it, done right, it's all for the good, and ultimately it'll come right. When a person is involved in suffering, that's really hard to hear. But the fact that suffering does sometimes create opportunity and create good is part of that same paradox. Germination, taking a seed and putting it in the ground, what happens to that seed? It decays. But out of that decay should come life. paradoxical. We used to it. We see it happening over and over again. We used to it, but it's still paradoxical. It doesn't have logical explanation to it. It has scientific explanation, but not logical explanation. What we need to understand is that this concept of chok, of this non-rational statute, is something that is not restricted to the red heifer. It's not even restricted to a body of laws such as the red heifer. It's not even restricted to the laws of the Torah. Everything in the universe has within it an element of chok, an element of paradox. Every principle, everything, every experience has within it an element of paradox. And if we don't access that paradox and recognize it, we don't begin to deal with the reality of what it really is. We're dealing with superficialities. Because on the surface there's no paradox. If you look at things superficially, you don't see paradox. When do you see paradox? As you start getting deeper into an issue, then you start getting to the paradox. The paradox lies at the soul. The paradox lies at the kernel of an idea. The deeper you get into it, the more you see the paradox. Let us define it in the following way. Mishpat. What is mishpat? That one category of laws, the rational laws, honoring parents, not stealing, not murdering. Mishpat is when you have a law that is the outcome of reason. So if I say to you, there is a law, thou shalt not murder. Where does that law come from? That's logical. It makes sense. If you want to construct and preserve a society, you must have such a law. So the law is the outcome of the reason. Chok is when reason is the outcome of the law. Let me explain that. When Newton said, if he ever did, why does the apple fall down and not fly up? And from that he developed the law of gravity. Was there rationale which gave rise to the law? Or did he say, there is a law? Nothing I can do about that. Now let me figure out why it is. When you look at a reality and you say, this is a law, whether it's a law of science, a law of nature, or a law of God, this is a law. Now let me figure out the reason. That's chok. When you say, here is a moral principle, what are the legal outcomes? That is mishpat. And there are two different ways of observing the world, in all areas of the world, not just law and morality, in all areas of the world. You can start with a principle and say, what are the outcomes of the principle? That's the mishpat kind of reasoning. And it's a legitimate way of reasoning. But there is also another way of looking at the world, and that is to say, this is a law, I can see that for sure. Apples fall down, they don't fly up. Now let me figure out the connection. I must work out why there must be a reason. I start with the law, and I develop the reason to satisfy the facts. And all of scientific theses are based on that. Any scientific thesis is you observe facts, and you design a law that explains the fact. Are you sure the law is true? No, because next year maybe somebody else will come and give a better explanation of the facts. And you'll have to abandon your understanding. So in the area of science, these theses are not absolute. It is a system of logic we use to explain the facts. We know the facts are there. That there's no argument about. The question is why. So when the outcome follows the reasoning, that's mishpat. When the reasoning follows the outcome, that's chok. Different way of reasoning. Then with the chok is how do you access it? To access a mishpat is easy. You start with a principle that's easy to grasp. So you say the principle is society, protection of society. What are the laws you need to implement in order to protect society? There mustn't be murder, there mustn't be theft, maybe even we'll get as far as Lashon Hara, we mustn't damage each other's reputation. But we'll put into place a body of laws starting with that concept that one is able to access. That's easy. That's, you extrapolate a system of laws from a moral principle that is universally accepted. But how do you access a chok? The one way of accessing a chok is through the Torah, obviously. God says that's one way of accessing the chok. But how else do you access a chok? Or more correctly, how do you access the chok that lies at the soul of every idea? How do you access the mystery, the paradox that lies behind every principle, behind every law, behind every idea? for that we need to understand that there is that reason is not the only way of access. That one can access certain things directly. For example, one would access aesthetics directly. If you look at a beautiful scene or a beautiful work of art, and you start trying to analyze scientifically what it is about that painting that pleases you, you miss it. You've actually got no chance of artistic appreciation. You might have other appreciations. You might appreciate the chemistry, and you might appreciate the physiology of the eye that appreciates all sorts of other things you will appreciate. But the artistry of the work you will miss. If you use reason to explain your response to a work of art, you will lose the work of art. If you're listening to a piece of music and you start figuring out the sound waves, using laws of physics, and how the different sound waves are interacting and why they're impacting on your ear in such a way that is creating a pleasant sensation, you will miss the artistry of the music. You will understand the science of the music. You will understand the physics of the sound waves and of the harmonies. But you will miss the soul of the music. There's no way you can access the soul of the music by analyzing the music scientifically. And we often make that mistake of trying to access the soul using the reason. A chok cannot be accessed using reason. A chok has to be directly accessed. A chok is the soul of an idea. And the soul of an idea can only be accessed by the soul of a human being. And if you're using your soul to access, you can access the chok directly. That's difficult stuff, and I'm going to expand and explain it a little bit more clearly still. Understand this is to overcome the concern we would have. The concern that we would have is this is dangerous stuff. Once we start talking about accessing knowledge and wisdom with something other than reason, then you're opening yourself to anything. Call it Kabbalah, and they can sell you anything, and they can tell you, you know what? Access, it doesn't matter if it's not rational, this is soul stuff, this is spiritual, whatever. You can do anything. You can sell a person anything that way. And people are being sold all sorts of things and all sorts of religions, including our own, on the basis that you don't need to understand it. It doesn't have to be rational. Now say the Nishma, just accept it because God says. There's an enormous danger in opening up an area of the Torah as critical as chok and saying you don't need reason to access it. And here's the important part of this understanding. I'm going to read and translate a few lines of a passage from the Michtav Gedeon, from Rabbi Yehuda Dessler, the recent authority, and since the war, who says and explains the following. Commensurate with the level of soul purity, of purity of the soul. What we need to understand is there's a whole part of ourselves that is called the soul. And that understands things, that can access things, but that soul needs to be trained, needs to have an ear, it needs to be refined. Based on the level of its purity, the human being is capable of accessing the soul of the Torah. Now we're introduced to a whole new concept. The Torah also has soul. And what you expose to superficially is not necessarily its soul. What you expose to superficially is its body, its skeleton, its surface. That there is the capacity to access the soul of the Torah. But for that there needs to be a purity of soul in the individual. And here he divides the Torah again into the Chok and the Mishpat. And he says the Mishpat system of reasoning is accessing the surface of the Torah. So yes, you can go through that process. Here's a principle, it's a good moral principle, it's a principle in the Torah. What are the laws that spin off from this principle? Understand the laws in light of that principle, and you're understanding the skeleton of the Torah. So you're accessing the skeleton of the Torah by that process of reasoning. The Chop process of reasoning accesses the soul of the Torah. What is that? He says the following, listen carefully. If an individual is attached to God, so now there's a connectedness, there is a soul connectedness to God. So I'm not watching it clinically. The beauty of reason is you can stand outside of an object and you can analyze the object from a distance. That's what clinical reasoning is about. You can take something to pieces, you can stand up it, and you can dismantle it until the point where you're able to understand it. But there is another way of understanding, and that is through an attachment to God. The person feels in the depths of his heart a complete containment within God. So now he's not standing outside and saying, I as an outsider want to understand the rationale of that law. I want to understand what God is doing and why God is doing it. He and God become one. Just as you don't say that about yourself very often. When you have something, you feel thirsty, you want a glass of water, you don't go through the whole process of, now let's figure that out. Why am I thirsty? What is the physiology that's taking place in my body? It's not relevant. The fact is you feel the thirst, you know that for sure, and you know that a glass of water would quench your thirst. And knowing that, you take the water and you drink it. There's that kind of intimacy that one can theoretically achieve with God, where the spiritual, the soul of God and one's own soul is so connected that God's will and your own will are perfectly aligned. And we're talking about a very advanced stage. And what I'm telling this to you for is not to tell you that that's the stage that we need to be at. We couldn't be at that stage. But what's important to realize is that until one gets to that stage, one has to be using the rational methodology. But it is a process of using reason to the point where you have such a connectedness that you no longer need to use reason to access the soul. So we're not saying this is a religion that doesn't require reason. We're not saying that a beginner who's never learnt and who's never studied can use anything but reason to access the truth. No, we're saying that until one is thoroughly schooled in the principles and the methodology and lives an incredibly pure life, until that stage, there's no way you can access except through reason. But you need to know that all you're accessing is the skeleton. Because to access the soul, you need to use your soul. And you're not schooled in using your soul, and your soul isn't developed, and your soul isn't refined. So to start learning Kabbalah, even if the Kabbalah that was being taught was genuine, which in most cases it isn't, even if it were genuine, to be able to access that, to be able to learn that before the soul is prepared, never mind the mind, before the soul is sufficiently refined, and the mind is sufficiently trained, and one has gone through enough of the intellectual and the analytical process, that you couldn't do. So the difference is, the differentiation is, there are religions and there are experiences that claim the abandonment of reason as a precondition to access. We're not saying that. We're saying reason is the precondition. You have to go through reason before you can get to accessing directly with the soul. But the Chok is not a law that is not understandable. A Chok is a law that can be fully understood only when you penetrate the essence of that law with your soul, not with your mind. And every law has a kernel of Chok. And every principle in life has a kernel of Chok. And one has to be able to access that. Let us look back at some of the difficulties that we had at the outset and see their resolution. Moshe says to God, you sent me to Egypt to deal with Pharaoh and to liberate the Jewish people. But ever since I've come, all I've seen is increased pain and hardship. What is the flaw in the logic? And therefore says Moshe, I think we should pull out of this. It's been getting worse and worse. So I must draw a conclusion that the more we involve in this, the worse it gets for the Jews. So if we have the Jewish interests at heart, then God, you and I should clear out of this and leave it to Pharaoh. Because before we got involved, it wasn't so bad. Is there a flaw in the logic? No. The logic is perfect. The flaw is its only logic. The flaw is paradox isn't being confronted. But out of pain, out of the pain. And you cannot use the normal laws of cause and effect to be able to say, look, we've been here for 6 months and it's been getting worse, therefore we should pull out. Now, if you know the worker, you have a doctor who might be treating a patient, and the patient says, you know, you put me on these drugs and it's been getting worse. And the doctor says, well, I told you that would happen. For 2 months it's going to get worse before you start feeling better. So that's, so do I have to pay you to come and take drugs to make me feel worse? And the answer is yes, if you want to get better. Sometimes we have to go through a decline in order to be able to bring ourselves out. That's the paradox. Do we understand that rationally? Not necessarily. Don't always understand it rationally. Can we work out a scientific explanation? Yes, we can if we start with the axiom. If the doctor says you're going to get worse before you get better, then you can say, well, explain why. Once we accept the axiom, we can work out the reasoning, but it doesn't work the other way around. So when Moshe says to God, ever since we've come in, it's been getting worse, what to him, what is the axiom? There isn't an axiom, there's just logic. The logic is, I've been watching a progression, it's been getting worse, let's change something, because what we're doing isn't working. Perfectly logical. But in terms of the big picture, God says to him, Moshe, there are times, so many times in history where I've had to put people through difficulty. A piece of the Sfas Emes, that's one of the great works that the Geira dynasty produced, the Hasidim of Geira, there are then the Sfas Emes, writes the following about a chok, and it just puts a different spin on it that is so important to appreciate. He says, "Ein lechol rishus la'arefa." You can't question a chok. Vada yesh tam lechol chukah. Of course, there is logic behind every chok. Every one of these irrational statutes have reason. Rak she'i efshar lahavinoi. Just that it's impossible to understand them. Those reasons. Listen to the next part. Ad shemekablim ha-mitzvah kechukah b'litam. Until you've accepted the axiom without reason. Whereas normal laws, mishpat, you cannot understand until you've understood the reason. With chok, first you better understand the soul, then you'll come to the reason. You better access the soul first, and then the reason will become clear. You can't get to the soul via the reason in the case of the chok. And so God says to Moshe, this is chok. You're dealing with the way I run the world. I run the world with chok. I run the world with mystery. I run the world with something bigger than you. There's no way you can stand outside and take a view and try and think that you've encompassed my reasoning and that you understand the sequence of events sufficiently to tell me to pull out of the job. And you should know that from the study of history. You should know that from your forefathers. You should know that from the experience of Abraham. You should be able to see that already. But that's how I operate. That you have to accept the paradox, experience the paradox, and then work out the reasoning from that. And so Moshe is punished. He's punished with not going into Israel. Although the actual statement of that punishment comes later on when he strikes the rock. And why does he strike the rock? Says the Rashbam, he just says to himself, this God can't mean speak to the rock. That's just crazy. He tells me to take the stick and then speak to the rock in front of all of the people. And I explained on Shabbos, in front of all of the people, all over the millions of them, there were video cameras, they could see everything. And on a full screen, they could see Moshe walking up to this rock, stick in hand, and now Moshe's going to start speaking. Rock, these people are thirsty. Would you mind giving them some water? And it's absurd. There's no way you could attach any kind of reasoning to that. So Moshe says, God couldn't have meant that. God must have said, hit the rock, speak while you're hitting it. But surely there must be physical contact. Because with physical contact, there can be some kind of scientific explanation. There was a hidden wall underneath here, and by hitting the rock, he moved it, and the wall came out. There's some kind of scientific explanation you could offer for hitting the rock. All the miracles, there was some kind of scientific explanation for. The splitting of the Red Sea, there were winds, and there were earthquakes, and there was this, and there was that, caused tidal waves. There are ways to explain it all scientifically. Speak to the rock. Don't explain that scientifically. That's if you don't accept paradox. But if you do accept paradox, you say, as I explained on Shabbos, speaking to a rock is not that much more absurd than speaking to people. That the rock should obey you is not much more astounding than the people should obey you and should be affected by you. Why should it be that one can stand on one end of the room and another person can stand on another end of the room, that person can speak and the other person should be able to hear and translate into meaning? That's astounding. That's absolutely astonishing. It's true. Once you accept the axiom, you'll find the scientific explanation. Now that you know people can speak, you'll work out why. But could you have invented it? Imagine that God created the world without sound, without ears, without mouths, without the ability to transfer sound across the air. Would you have been able to create it? Would you have thought about it? Would you have created the law from the principle? No. Once you accept the law, the fact is, you stand there, I stand there, you speak, I hear, something must be happening between us, let's discover what it is. So the way science works is with chok. Science doesn't work with reason, science works with chok. It accesses the rule, the facts, and then it figures out the thesis. And God says to Moshe, you should be doing the same. The fact is, I said, talk to the rock, that means rocks can hear. Absurd? Everything's absurd. Life is absurd. Of course it's absurd. If you want to figure out why, get all your scientists to study rocks and study speech, and one day they'll work out how it happened. But you don't have to wait until they've figured it out. Meanwhile, I'm telling you to speak. We have to be able to access the truth before we understand it fully. And then of course we have to try and understand it. We're obligated. The Rambam says even the chok, every one of them, we must apply our minds and unravel them and explore them and master them as best we possibly can. But you don't always have to wait until you've understood it before you get to the soul. Sometimes you miss the soul if you try to understand it before you get to the soul. There are those laws you need to understand first, but there are some laws you need to access first, and then you'll understand them. Science you need to understand measurably. Art you need to access, and then you understand. Some laws are artistic, and some laws are scientific. Some laws have a calculated framework that you can analyze. Some laws have an artistic framework that you cannot analyze. And the chok is a law that has an artistic framework. And therefore Moshe's error, if we will call it that, in the case of the rock, was the same error that he made in Egypt when he accused God of delivering more suffering rather than delivering liberation. Why the death of righteous people atones is because the death of righteous people is a paradox. So if you analyze it rationally, you've got to say, why? I can't accept a God that does this. Here was such a righteous person, and look what's happened, and there are all these wicked people wandering around who are doing very well. So the death of a righteous person creates an existential crisis in a person. And this is his opportunity. If he's going to use the rational, he's going to miss the art. And the art is what we say at the graveside. Atzul tonen parol. All of God's actions are perfect. That's the principle. That's the rule. That's the law. Now go and figure it out. Spend the rest of your life trying to figure it out. That's fine. Do that. But you don't have to postpone life while you're figuring it out. You don't have to postpone a relationship with God while you're figuring it out. Access it directly. Feel the moment. Experience what's happening. Experience the mystery of death. Experience the riddle of death. Experience the enormity of death. So as to bring light to life. Access the soul of what's just happened. And later on you can try and ask all the questions and answer them. But don't let that hold up the process of accessing life. And that's what the poor Adima does as well. Sometimes you've got to understand that a product that is negative, like death, can produce something that is positive. This world can produce the world to come. And that's why Moshe is able to grasp it and Solomon isn't. Because Moshe has experienced paradox. In fact, the very introduction of Moshe to his mission was through paradox, the burning bush. If Moshe would have said, hey, one second, this bush is burning, it's on fire, and it's not being consumed. Let's send the question off to the great universities of the world, and when the physicists of the world figure out the reason, then I'll decide whether this is a miracle, or it's God, or whatever it is. By that time, the Jews would have been dead. We wouldn't have gotten out of Egypt. Moshe responds immediately, this is mystery, this is miracle, this is God. Let me go and feel it, let me go and experience it. The scientists can figure it out afterwards what happened and how God did it. But I'm not going to allow the reasoning process to delay my direct access soul to soul of somebody spiritual, able to feel, being able to feel that this is holy, this is sanctity, and being able to access the sanctity directly. And so Moshe has experienced paradox. He's seen it in Egypt. He seen God say to him at the burning bush, go and get the Jews up. And 2 weeks later, a month later, a year later, the Jews are in worse trouble than ever. He's seen the paradox. And he saw how they had to go through that in order to come out the way they did. He's seen that. He's seen all of this. Moshe can understand paradox. Moshe can understand the red heifer. Moshe can understand Chok. King Solomon, brilliant. But he didn't live a life of paradox. He tried to create paradox in his writings and in his thinking. But in his life experience, he lived a life of luxury as a king, as a prince from the day he was born, later on a king, wealth, honor, glory. He didn't have the experience of paradox that Moshe had. And to understand the paradox, you need life experience, not intellectual brilliance. Only when you've lived through it over and over again and learned how to access it directly rather than through reason, do you develop the capacity to treat life artistically and not always scientifically. The life artist is the person who's lived the paradox of life and can access it. The life scientist misses the art in life as he tries to understand and understand and understand. And it's interesting that the last thing I bring you is the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Zayin. Now the Gemara says, Shlosha Devarim Bikesh Moshe Mlifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe asked God for three things. And God agreed. Number one, Bikesh Shetishtu Shechino on Yisrael. He asked that God's presence should rest on the Jewish people. They should experience God directly. They should be able to access God. And God agreed. Number two, Bikesh Shetishtu Shechino Alev Bekechovim. He asked that idolaters should not be able to access God directly. And God agreed. That means until that time, idolaters could also access God directly. Very interesting discussion, which we're going to get into now. But Moshe put a stop to that. So Jews should be able to access God, idolaters should not be able to access God. God agrees. The third one, he says to God, Bikesh, requested Lohidio Derochot Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Tell me your system of reward and punishment. Explain to me how you work, because I don't understand that. And God gave it to him. What exactly was he asking? Explains the Gemara. Amar Lefanav, he said to him, Ribono Shel Olam, God, if you've ever asked this question, at least you know you're not the first one. Mipnei Mai Yesh Tzadik V'Tov Lo. Why are there some righteous people who are good and some righteous people who are bad? Wicked people who are good and wicked people who are bad. I must conclude that righteousness and wickedness is irrelevant to you because it seems to have nothing to do with how people live. There are righteous people who live well and righteous people who suffer. Wicked people who live well and wicked people who suffer. So morality and consequence don't go hand in hand. There is no consequence to morality. There is no consequence to immorality. Please explain this to me because I cannot live without an understanding of this. And God said, I will. Would you like to have God's answer? Next week. But next week is the 4th of July. So next week is the 4th of July, and people will be doing all sorts of different things, I suppose. Can we try and get the have the shiur on another night? Or do you want it on the Monday night? Monday is the holiday, so by Monday night are people back and ready to come to the shiur? Yes. Okay, so next Monday night we will have the shiur where we will deal with God's reply to Moses of why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. What is the relationship between action and consequence? Just before we end off, I'm prepared to take just a few questions, one or two questions, because the subject matter was difficult. In developing it further next week, it will become a little bit clearer. So one or two questions, and then we'll break the tea.
Yeah. If Moses lived a life of paradox and could understand paradox, then why did he fail on two occasions where to have this necessary understanding?
An important question, I should have made that clear, sorry. It was his failure that taught him the lesson and enabled him to learn it. The suffering of that failure, because he suffered a terrible consequence. the suffering of that punishment put him in a position to be able to grasp it.
Even though it was subsequent to the burning bush where he apparently had
the... Yeah, there was a string of events, but what finally positioned Moshe to understand paradox was after the hitting of the rock, when God said, that's it, you don't get it either. When he felt the pain of paradox and had to deal with that and grow through that, that was the time, according to the presentation I'm giving you, that he grasped the principles of Chok and was able to understand the paradox.
And ask those questions.
And ask those questions as well as part of that, absolutely.
Yes, sir. Adult, access to God, first of all, they don't believe in God.
Sorry, what was that?
You said, like, Moshe wanted to confess what that
should be. I don't wish, but shouldn't they have access to God?
Yes, but how could they want you to access God if they don't believe in God in the first place? And if they're not asking for anything, or...
Idol worshippers do believe in God. They merely believe in idols as God's representatives. It's fallacious to think that there were idol worshippers that don't believe in God at all, but most idol worshippers do believe in God. They'll just say, this is God's son, or this is God's object, or this represents God's wife, or this represents God's mother, and they create physical manifestations of God. The creation of a physical manifestation of God is idolatry, not substituting God. So even when people believe in God but create a physical object to represent God, that is idolatry. Okay? Good?
I was just thinking about the questioning whether it's really that paradoxical that the pain and negativity is being forced upon you. Like, for example, if you're smelting iron, you take a big piece of ore and you heat it up and the fire burns away and the impurities and you see suffering on it. Like that too, and that doesn't seem illogical.
It's only not illogical because you see it and you understand it. It's not logical. The fact that you see it happening over and over again doesn't make it logical. It doesn't explain the rationale of the relationship between one and the other. There are many things in life. I said, in fact, everything in life has this element of paradox which we accept when we see it repeated over and over again and it becomes predictable. So now you know that in order to harden a piece of steel you have to soften it first, and in order to soften it you have to harden it first, and that's kind of, but since you know that and you've created some kind of scientific explanation for it, you begin to accept it. But from a true logical perspective it doesn't make sense. Why should that be the process? Why should God have made the world in such a way when you have to go through such an opposite swing? So it doesn't make it less paradoxical, it just makes it predictable. Right, absolutely. So don't confuse paradox with non-predictability. There are many predictable things that are still paradoxical. Okay, let's leave it there for you. Thank you.